Okay, so let's come back to the questions again. It's the last chance tonight, so let's see what we have to deal with here. So, dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you very much for your dedicated and inspiring teachings for the past 10 days. It has been truly wonderful. An important question: do you take on lay students? That means provide guidance on teaching on our path. Well, that's what you are here now, right? You are lay students. You have come here to learn meditation practice. This is how you become a lay student of the Buddhist society. You're always welcome to ask questions of me whenever, you know, if I'm around. So that's no problem. But I don't think personal students is such a good idea. But I'm always willing to ask questions, as is probably Ajahn Brahm and everyone else at the monastery. So if I'm there, please, you're always welcome to contact me here. Yeah, I hope that's good enough. I hope you're happy with that. Okay, you mentioned how just seeing the Buddha can uplift someone. Ajahn Brahm also has that effect. Often I have been in a foul mood, which has totally lifted upon seeing, hearing Ajahn Brahm. This happened even at the start when I wasn't so into Dhamma. But I have also taken friends to see him and they have felt nothing. What's going on? Is there actually something that good meditators can do to other people's minds? I think it just depends on, you know, who you are as a person, what kind of qualities you have, whether you are tuned in to certain things and what you experience. We are very different, and sometimes some people will inspire you, others will not. It just varies. And, you know, there are people who come into the presence of the Buddha and they were angry with the Buddha and they would shout at him. And you find this in the suttas. And obviously they wouldn't have felt any presence. They wouldn't have felt anything in particular because they were so full of defilements. They couldn't see what was actually there to be seen. So that is part of the problem. Often you cannot really, you know, as I say, you can take the horse to the water, but you can't make it drink. You know, you can take them to see Ajahn Brahm, but you can't actually make them experience anything. And that's just the way it has to be, I suppose. In the end, it's about the practice of the Buddha's teachings. And even if you don't feel anything in the presence of somebody, that is not the most important thing. The most important thing is to have a sense of faith and confidence in the Buddha's teachings. And if seeing somebody can help, that is great. If not, it is not absolutely required. Sometimes it can be more like you read the suttas and think, wow, this is really good stuff, right? You meet somebody who is practicing well, you think, wow, there's different ways of approaching that. I have found the best thing is a combination of the two, when you have both the see the example and also you read the suttas. Maybe not so helpful, but today you are here. My heart feels very full and happy. It has been a wonderful retreat. I feel truly blessed and fortunate to have been on this retreat with Ajahn Brahmali and so many wonderful retreatants. So many familiar faces, people who have been supporting the BSW for so long. Thank you, everyone. Also a little sadness that it must end. Yes, it must end, but there will be other ones in the future, right? There are always new possibilities in the future. That's very kind of you to say those words. It's always uplifting and nice. Dear Ajahn, this is a follow-up to one of last night's questions. It may be easier for some to face death than to face illnesses. With death, you just die, but with poor health, gets in the way of practice, including meditation. How could one develop oneself in a way that helps to overcome the difficulties that frequent illness presents to one on the path? Thanks, Ajahn. One of the things is that, it is a wonderful opportunity, or maybe not wonderful, but it is an opportunity to learn acceptance, accepting things the way they are, to understand that, we have very limited power sometimes over our lives and over our bodies. And sometimes you just have to say, okay, I'm going to live with this. I'm going to just let it be here. And just make the most of it. Often if it upsets you and it kind of you are angry about it and you're unhappy about the fact that your body isn't working the way it should, then it kind of hinders your peace of mind. It hinders your development of the path, right? And all of these things. So much better to accept things. Okay, this is the reality. I've got to it's going to have to be like this, so let's keep going. And then sometimes you may find little solutions, right? Little things that make it easier for you, little things that kind of make your head in the right direction regardless. So acceptance is, I think, is very crucial. Ajahn Brahm tells an amazing story about himself when he was in Thailand. He was at this remote monastery and he got this really bad toothache. You may have heard this story before. And he said it was a very, very bad toothache. It was so bad, he didn't know what to do with himself. He was walking back and forth, sitting down, trying to meditate, I'm not sure if he's standing on his head, but he was willing to do anything to get rid of this toothache, right? But nothing worked. And then he realized, well, you know, if nothing works, all I can do is to accept. So he did that. So he sat down. And at that moment, he was able, because it was like an insight, right? It came to him, I have to accept, there's no other way out. He accepted 100%. At that moment, the toothache just vanished, he said, completely. It was the most unbearable toothache up to that point. And then it was completely gone 1 second later. And that is kind of the astonishing power sometimes of acceptance. If you do it at the right place, at the right time, it can really, because you are changing your perception of something here. You're allowing things to be, no longer fighting it, allowing it to be part of you. This is probably one of those things that you have to do. And then continue with your meditation practice, right? Continue with doing things, develop your mind. And maybe one day you will be able to develop your mind in such a way that you can go beyond that body, right? Beyond the body completely, so you don't actually have many of those problems that kind of fade away. And they say that if you can get into deep meditations like that, it often has a very healing power on the body as well. Your body is going to feel much better when you come out of those meditations. After those kind of meditations, it's like there's no problem in the body. You may have been sitting still for hours, quite literally. A really good meditator, they might sit still for 10 hours, 12 hours without moving at all. And when they come out, their body is completely relaxed, completely at ease. There's no pains whatsoever. And that is kind of the power of those meditations. It's not easy. And it's easy for me to say I don't really have any great illnesses, except for all the usual stuff with pains here and pains there, which everybody has, but nothing really bad. It's sometimes easy to say these things. It's hard to do, but it's worthwhile trying because people say it can give very good results. So. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, I wrote down one of your quotes yesterday. Craving is a lie. It promises something but never delivers. That's a great line. Thank you. Thank you also for the wonderful Siddha sessions. They have been enlightening with metta. Okay, great. Wonderful. Some more. And these are very easy questions today. Very uplifting questions, right? Really, really nice ones. Dear Bhante, is there a specific reason why the perception of impermanence is undertaken with the five khandhas and the perception of non-self with the salayatanas, the six sense bases? Are there other examples in the suttas where it is the other way around? Thank you for the wonderful retreat. It is very helpful in many ways with metta. It's a good question. I am not sure exactly why that is. I suspect perhaps that they wanted to, perhaps in this particular sutta, they wanted to have both the perception of impermanence and also the perception of non-self. And because they were going to have both, they used different objects on each one so as to be more inclusive perhaps. That may be the only reason. It is in the suttas, you can use the perception of impermanence or non-self or dukkha on the five khandhas. You can use exactly the same perceptions on the six senses, six sense places. If you want to find out more about this, you can go to the Sanghita Nikaya, and there's lots of suttas in there, heaps of suttas about how to contemplate the five factors of personality, the khandhas, and also the six sense places. And it's always based around impermanence, suffering, and non-self, all of them. So I don't think there is any particular reason. As far as I know, I could be wrong about that. If you can find a good reason, please let me know. It is a little bit, basically it's uncertain. Okay. Dear Ajahn, is the only way to connect with the core meaning of life through jhana? What about the hum of joy that can arise through mindful and virtuous living with metta? Yes, that is certainly true. You are already moving in that direction. If you live a good life with mindfulness and virtue and goodness, you are moving towards that, right? There's a degree of contentment there already, a degree of happiness, a degree of satisfaction, a degree of completeness. So yes, it is true. But the idea here is to move to the full satisfaction, the absolute point of satisfaction, where there's nothing, no craving. You can just sit there forever, it feels like, right? Sit there forever and it's no problem. That is kind of the contentment, right? You have found kind of, there's nothing more to do. If you find the full meaning of life, it means there's nothing more to do. You don't have to go anywhere anymore. You don't have to move anywhere. There's nothing more to be done. Complete satisfaction. So it is a very, very high state of, you know, something very powerful when you experience these things. It is literally kind of out of this world because you don't have any interest in this world anymore, in the ordinary sense of desiring things and all of these. So these are really otherworldly experiences. So that's why they're so powerful. You're quite right, but it's like one stage, right? And you move on further, and you move on further. And after a while you wonder, wow, this is just astonishing where this path is taking me. Things are getting more and more profound, more and more deep, more and more meaningful, more and more complete. Gee, this is where is it all going to end, right? This is sometimes how you feel. Yes. But you're on the right track there. If you can feel that in ordinary life, then you have a very good foundation for also getting even deeper in your meditation practice. Okay. Dear Ajahn, is practicing present moment awareness important in our meditation practice? If it's important, how can we do it? Thank you. Yes, it is very important. In fact, it is the basis for all good meditation is to have a sense of present moment awareness. And the way to do it is just to accept the present moment, to be at ease in the present moment, right? So I should have emphasized this a bit more during the meditations, but the idea that I was talking about on the very first day is just to relax, to be at ease, to feel good right here, right now. And the more relaxed and at ease you are, the more happy is the present moment, right? If you have pain in the body and all kind of problems, it makes the present moment unpleasant. But the idea is by just relaxing and be at ease, just enjoying being here. Wow, it's wonderful. It is peaceful. It is what a blessing to be part of this, right? You're getting into this beautiful positive mode, mood and mood, both. and then you start to come into the present moment. It is happiness, joy, a sense of well-being that allows the mind and all the thinking to die down and kind of dissipate, and the kind of pure awareness of the present moment to arise. So that's how you do it. Just allow it to come by itself. You can't really do it. You kind of just allow other things to disappear by the wayside. And it's that happiness which makes it possible. This is still a very low form of happiness, but it's a degree of contentment and happiness with what is here. So feel the body. Allow the body to relax. And when the body kind of feels really, really easy and relaxed, then there's very few problems left. And the mind kind of starts to emerge into the present moment. Because all the tensions in the mind are felt in the body. When the body relaxes, the mind also relaxes. There's very few problems left. Good idea if you're going to do meditation at home is to have a guided meditation, because sometimes it can be hard to get into the right mood and the right feelings. So by having a guided meditation by some meditation teacher who you like to listen to, you can play that guided meditation, and it can kind of creates the atmosphere, creates the mood, reminds you of the steps, right? And then you're guided along as a consequence. Okay. Dear Ajahn Ramali, thank you so much for the amazing week, with so many good Dhamma talks on the suttas. I feel very blessed with such rousing talks on dependent origination. I feel very inspired to practice diligently. You have given us all a very special gift of the Dhamma. Thank you also to Bianca, who is like a saint, caring for us all and organizing such a seamless, enjoyable retreat. May she reach Nibbana. Okay? In this very life. Thank you also to the generous Dana donors who made our stay comfortable. We are so fortunate. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Excellent. Wonderful. That is very, very good. So it's always nice to remember all the good things. And that's great. Okay, dear Ajahn, one of the best retreats I attended. It was informative, had no problems listening to you. May you attain Nibbana in this life with metta. Okay, good. So, this is going to be very quick and very uplifting at the same time. It's really very good. Dear Ajahn, could you discuss the fear of letting go? Is the fear equal in intensity to the craving which holds on to the possessions, persons, or objects in the first place with metta? Yes, that in a sense is a good way of looking at it. Of course, the fear of letting go is going to be proportional to the intensity of the holding on. But usually you can't really get into deep meditation if you have a lot of craving, right? That craving and attachment will stop you in the first place, in a sense. So usually when you get very close to the deep states of samadhi, whatever, already you have let go of a lot at that point. And this is why, you know, in the suttas it always says that if you have samadhi, you have wisdom. If you have wisdom, you have samadhi. They always go together here. Because you cannot get to the jhanas without wisdom. Because wisdom is measured by how easily you can let go of things. If you are wise, you can let go of things easily. If you can let go of things easily, you can get into samadhi. So wisdom and samadhi, again, that's another way of understanding how they have to go together. So, you know, this, if anyone says that, someone just has samadhi, they have no wisdom, it doesn't work like that. You have to have both together. So, but there is, of course, some degree of what you are saying there, and some people are very afraid of letting go. They think letting go is dangerous, and you have to kind of hold on to things because then, otherwise, there's nobody to control it, right? There's a fear of being out of control, the fear of what's going to happen if somebody isn't holding on and trying to steer it in the right way. And, of course, that trying to steer things and control things usually just makes it worse. Because you don't really know what is right, you don't know which direction things should take. You are deluded by the craving in the first place, and you make a mess of it, really. This is one of the nice things about living at Buddhinyana Monastery with Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm is very, very uncontrolling of his monks, and he allows the monks to do pretty much exactly what they want, within limit. I mean, as long as you keep the Vinaya, as long as you keep the rules at least, then you can do pretty much exactly what you want. So, and he has that trust in people, right? And it kind of plays to people's sense of responsibility, and usually it works. People take that responsibility on board. They spend their life well, they do the right thing. And often it actually leads to good results, and it also leads to less work for Ajahn Brahm that he can let go in that way. But it's very nice to live in a place where you don't feel controlled, in a place where you feel that, you know, you are just doing things out of your own free will according to as far as free will goes, but you're doing things because you feel this is what you want to do, this is what is right. You judge your own situation. What do you need? What do you require here? So this is a very, very good thing. It's actually few monasteries that have that sense of ease and just letting go, because most people, even senior monastics and monasteries, they also have a fear sometimes of letting go, because there's a sense that things might get out of hand, right? Things may go the wrong way, so you have to have some controlling here. But usually, I think it is actually the exact opposite. When you let go, that's when things go much more smoothly here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, this Nanda retreat is like living in the heaven realm. Wonderful Dhamma talks. Peaceful and calm. Good meditation, good company, good food. What a wonderful holiday. Thank you. Okay. That's good, great. So that's a thank you note to everyone. So maybe you had some experience of the heavenly realm in the meditation, right? So you know what they're like. So now, maybe that was what it's... So, okay, excellent. Okay, but don't give too much rise to craving for the heavenly realm as the consequence. Anyway, so here we go, next one. Dear Ajahn, could you please tell us a little more about Sariputta and Moggallana and Moggallana Mahārattathera's? Thank you very much. These are like the Buddha's two main disciples, right, in the suttas. Venerable Sariputta was the one foremost in wisdom according to the suttas, and Venerable Mahamoggallana was the one foremost in all kind of psychic powers and that kind of stuff. When you see a Buddhist shrine, you often see the Buddhist shrine often has Venerable Sariputta and Mahamoggallana on the side of the Buddha, and you see Venerable Sariputta, he has his hand something like this, and Mahamoggallana has his hand like this in Anjali here. So you can tell which one is which. And then Sariputta should always be on the right side of the Buddha because he was his right-hand disciple, and Mahamoggallana should be on the left side. So now you know how to set up your shrine at home. That's the way it's supposed to do it according to tradition. If you don't get it right, it doesn't mean you go to hell or anything like that. But that's kind of the way it's supposed to be. And Venerable Sariputta has lots of discourses in the suttas that were given by him, and lots of them are very interesting suttas. And the Buddha said that if anyone should teach Dhamma, it should be him, because obviously he was very highly regarded at the time of the Buddha. And he was also very humble at the same time. Sometimes the wisest people are also the humblest ones. There's one very story about with Venerable Sariputta where he's walking along, and this little novice, right, here is this great kind of arahat, this absolute, the top pinnacle of arahats in the world, ultra wise and very good. He's also famous for his very profound meditation, very, very deep meditation as well. And this little novice, I don't know how old the novice was, 12 years old or something, he sees him, and his robe is not kind of fully properly on for some reason. And this novice goes up and says, "Oh, your robe is not properly on." It's a very cheeky little novice. Or maybe he was right. Maybe he was just trying to help out. We shouldn't be too judgmental about that either. And then when Sariputta, he kind of fixes up his robe and whatever. And then he says to the novice, "Thank you, teacher," afterwards. So this is kind of one of the great arahants in the history of the Buddhist teachings. So that is one story about him. Another story about Venerable Sariputta is the story about when he is about to die and pass away. I think this is in the Theragata, in his verses. And he says, maybe it's not when he's dying, maybe it's a little bit before he's dying. But he says that being an arahant is like a workman waiting for his wages. The work has been done, and now he just wants the wages. And the wages is, of course, passing into parinibbana at the end of life. So you don't speed it up by committing suicide, but also you're quite happy when it happens. That's kind of the idea there. Also, Venerable Sariputta, this is according to the commentaries, not really from the suttas as much, but when he was on his deathbed, he was dying, and he was dying at home, and his mother was still around apparently at that time. And his mother was this very staunch Brahmin woman. It looks like almost most of her sons, she had lots of sons, I don't know, 4 or 5 sons or something, and most of them had ordained as Buddhist monks. But she was a staunch Brahmin woman. She would have nothing to do with Buddhism. And then Venerable Sariputta, he comes back home, and he is on his deathbed, right? And when he's on his deathbed, all these heavenly beings come down, right? And they come down to pay his past respects, his last respects to him. So Sakka comes down, Mahabrahma comes down, and his mother sees all these lights in the house, right? All these divine, amazing beings coming into the house. That's Sakka coming to pay respect to me. That is Mahabrahma, kind of. He's the one that you worship all the time. He's coming to pay respects to me. Oh, really? Okay. And that apparently made some impact on her, right? This is something special. And I think based on that, apparently she became a Buddhist as well towards the very end of her life, apparently. It's a story. I don't know how much there's to it, but it's a kind of a nice little story here. And there are many such things about these two monks. When they first, at the very beginning, before they were ordained as monks, they were members of another sect. And they were under a teacher called Sanjaya Belatiputta. And he was a skeptic. And the skeptics, they were famous for not saying anything about what they thought. So if you ask them a question, they would say, I don't say that, nor do I say the opposite, nor do I say both, nor do I say, I don't say anything at all. Nor, and so they were known as eel wrigglers, because they never really answer any question at all, always wriggling one way or the other. So they kind of skeptics. And so they were disciples of him originally, and then but they weren't really satisfied with him. They were looking for something more profound. And then one day, this Upatissa was his name. This is Venerable Sariputta. He was walking around in Rajagaha. This was happening in Rajagaha, the capital of Magadha. And he was walking around in the city, and then he saw Venerable Asaji. Venerable Asaji was one of the first five monks of the Buddha. They got enlightened very soon after when the Buddha gave the first sermon, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta and the Anattalakkhana Sutta, the discourse on the characteristics of non-self. When Sariputta saw him, and he saw him, he was very inspired. He thought, wow, look at this monk, look at the bearing of this monk. If there are arahants in the world, this must surely be one of them. That's what he thought. So he went up to this Venerable Asaji, and he asked him, who is your teacher? And he said, you know, well, this monk called the Buddha is my teacher, or whatever. And then he said, well, what does he teach? He teaches that, and this was the teaching, right? It was, of all phenomena that have a cause, the Master Gautama has taught that they must cease. All phenomena that have a cause must cease. Is that exactly right? Yeah, exactly. So whatever dhammas have a root, a cause, it was sambhangtesang nirodang anyway, close enough. It doesn't really matter. But the point is that from hearing that simple sutta, a very simple saying, whatever things arise from a cause must also cease, he became a stream enterer, right? Stream enterer on the spot. Imagine that. That's all you hear. And it's a very simple teaching. That's the story anyway. And then he thinks, wow, okay, got it. So he goes back to Mahamoggallana, because they were friends at the time. And he tells him about that he has met this amazing teacher. So they decide to swap over religion, to give up on the Sanjaya Belatiputta and then move over to Buddhism instead. And they say to Sanjaya, they said, oh, please come with us, because we have found the real thing. And Sanjaya says, I am now so attached to honor and fame, I cannot let go of that anymore, so I have to continue the way things are. It's kind of very kind of strange, right? And now I'm so attached to honor and fame, I can't let go of that, so I have to continue being like a spiritual leader rather than kind of being somebody's disciple. And of course there's some truth to that. You might get attached to those things. You can see why that is the case. At least he was honest about it. Mahamoggallana, he of course also gives quite a few suttas, gives a few teachings. And I was telling you one before today, where he touches the palace of the king, or the heavenly king, and shaking the palace. That's one of the stories of Mahamoggallana. What else is there about him in the suttas? Does it do anything? There's lots of kind of later stories with Mahamoggallana where he does all kind of, you know, psychic fights and that sort of thing. There's one psychic fight with a very famous naga called Nanda Pananda Naga. And that's a story from the commentaries of the Dhammapada, I think, or something like that. Anyway, they were very very special people. I considered the Buddha's right-hand and left-hand disciples, respectively. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you very much for a wonderful and fruitful sutta retreat. When I read the suttas at home, I did not understand, but hearing you read and pausing at the right places, you made it so easy to understand. Thank you again with mega metta. This is the Ajahn Brahm disciples, right, with mega metta. You know, that's good. So, yes, this is one of the things, you know, you've been a monk for 20 years, you read the suttas all the time, because I remember what it was like when I started out, I was scratching my head, wondering what was going on. And one of the most beneficial things that happened to me was Ajahn Brahm did sutta readings at the Bodhinyana Monastery in the early days. Not so much anymore. Usually I do it now, but he did it in the early days. And I learned so much from that. I learned how to connect it all together, how it all functions together. And it's very, very, very useful. And one day you learn so much that you start arguing with your teacher, right? You say, Ajahn, you don't really understand this, do you? This is the right way. And then you have a friendly discussion, right? And that's actually also can sometimes be very nice. So you don't have to agree with me, you can disagree. And the more you know of the suttas yourself, the more ability you will have to disagree in a kind of useful way. And of course, the point is that nobody is going to be able to exhaust all these suttas. There is always more information in there, more interesting angles to look at them from, right? More inspiring ways to teach them. All this stuff is in there still, waiting to be kind of drawn out of them. And sometimes when you read the suttas, you will see things in there which I haven't seen or I haven't really emphasized, which will inspire you in your practice. So for that reason, sometimes it's worthwhile reading the suttas for yourself. Even the simple suttas, nice little similes, things that go straight to your heart, that inspire you, and that become very powerful, powerful in your practice. Okay. Dear Ajahn, some arahants are wiser than other arahants. What is the difference in their practice? Thank you. I think it's just natural kind of leanings of the mind. Some people tend to be wiser than others. They have more discernment, more ability to see what is going on, right? Perhaps some arahants are born more intelligent. They have more analytical abilities. So if you combine that intelligence with the spiritual abilities, maybe it becomes more powerful. You have more ability to analyze things and then explain things afterwards, perhaps. That might be one thing. You know, you don't have necessarily to be very... anyone can become an arahant. You just have to practice in the right way. So even if you're a very simple person with no education and nothing at all, and you get a very simple teaching, you might still become an arahant, but you may not have those skills that make you able to be wise in the sense that you can teach in the great diversity and that sort of thing. There is a sutta, not a sutta, this is actually not a sutta, this is in the commentaries. Possibly a little bit uncertain whether it really happened or not, but there was one monk at the time of the Buddha who was considered very, very stupid. And his name was Chula Pantaka. Pantaka means like the one who is traveling. So Chula means like small, so the small traveler or something like that. And there's a long story about him in the suttas. His brother was Mahapantaka. And he was considered very, very stupid. He couldn't do anything, basically. He couldn't remember anything. He couldn't kind of remember any of the suttas or anything like that. And so kind of the Buddha decides to give him a very, very simple way of understanding the Dhamma. So he gives him a white cloth and he says, just hold on to this white cloth. Keep holding on to this white cloth and then see what happens. So he has this white cloth, right, and he carries it around with him. And after a while, he sees the white cloth gets stained, right? And then from that very simple thing, he understands how the mind gets stained, just like the white cloth gets stained. And he understands about abandoning the defilements. So he was probably one of these people who had a very pure heart, right? Very pure heart, very good-natured, but also was very simple, no educational background, all those kind of things. Very simple at the same time. So he became an arahant. Once he was an arahant, then you become an inspiration for others, regardless of your ability to teach or whatever. All of those things are not so important. You still become a powerful inspiration. So it's just natural propensities, natural abilities, natural things that you have built up maybe over a long period in the past lives, etc. And that's why they are not wiser in one sense. It's important to understand that wisdom in Buddhism is measured by your ability to let go. So an arahant, all arahants have the same basic wisdom, that they have let go in the same way. So they have the same wisdom in one sense. It's just that their abilities to teach and the way it comes out is a little bit different. Okay. Dear Ajahn, is chanting good to do every day? I've heard of Metta Sutta, Ratana Sutta, Mangala Sutta are better. Can you please comment? Does chanting work because of the true words in them? Thank you. That is the the determination of truth, right? When you determine the truth, of course, sometimes it is said that that has a certain power in its own right. So is chanting good to do every day? It really depends on you. You know, I wouldn't, again, be careful of just getting into kind of all sorts of rituals that have no purpose. Sometimes people think that chanting is good, so I must do it every day, and it doesn't actually do anything for you. The most important thing is what it does for you. Does it make you feel better? Does it make you relax? Does it make you kind of get you in a good mood or whatever? If it does, you can do it, because then it actually has some purpose. If the chanting is, if you understand the Pali words or the words in whatever language, in English or whatever, again, it can be nice just to reflect on the suttas, reflect on what is important in life and what matters, how you can, you can actually use it as a reflection on the Buddha's teachings. So use it in a meaningful way. Don't just chant, think that it is good because of magic or whatever like that. Whether it is magic or not, I don't think there is much magic power in them, but so use them in a way whereby they actually have an impact on you, a positive impact. Then you are doing it the right way. So sometimes if you come, if you had a busy day and been everything, then it can be nice to put on a bit of paritta chanting to calm you down. And then you feel good. And then you can do some meditation afterwards. So all of that, all such things are, useful. It's probably better to do a bit of paritta chanting than to put on some heavy metal or something like that. Probably more useful, more calming, right? More peaceful. So, okay. Dear Ajahn, could you please briefly explain about the stages of death contemplation? I really enjoyed it when we did the death meditation, and I would like to practice at home more often. There isn't really any stages, I just made it up at the time, But it's kind of obvious what the stages are. You have to let go. So the way I would say the stages are that you have to let go in the right sequence. You start with the easier things and go towards the more profound things, right? That's kind of the obvious one. Actually, it's not entirely made up, because there are suttas about this as well. There is one sutta where Venerable Sariputta guides somebody when he's dying. And he starts off by saying, you are dying now. Your parents, there's no point in attaching to your parents. You're dying. You have to let go of them. So let's go of that. No point attaching to your wife and children, so let's go of that. No point in attaching to the human realm, so let's go of that. No point in attaching to any other realms, right? So let's go of that. So it kind of takes him through this death. This is like a death contemplation, letting go of one thing after the other until when he eventually dies, he becomes an anagami or something like that, a non-returner at the very last stage. So just do that. Ask yourself, what is a natural sequence to let go of things? And the first one is probably all your belongings, right? Probably the easiest one. So do that first. Then all the people, right? All your friends, acquaintances, and then family members. It's more difficult. Then you let go of your body, right? The body is even more close to you. And then eventually you can even let go of some of the mental content. The mental content that is related to this world, etc. And then if you have lived a good life and you're dying, then that process of dying will be very beautiful. It will be very nice. When you're free from all these things, you feel, whoa, freedom. You feel so nice. And then all these positive feelings will come out of you because of that. And because all the positive feelings come out, that's why I was saying towards the end of meditation, you feel like this gratitude, right, to the universe, to everybody. And then you feel, in return, you have the sense of metta as well to everything around you. So that's how I was. But I, there is no absolute right and wrong in these things. You can try that way. Whatever works really for you is the most important thing here. So if you can make it work, then that is what really matters. Okay. Dear Ajahn, if I request my relatives to hand over the body to UWA after my death, would there be any complication? UWA already has accepted this. Would there be any complication? I don't think so. I think that's a good idea. I think it's a very good idea. Because if they can use your body for whatever purpose, great. So I think, you know, I don't think there should be any problems as far as any, you know, yourself being kind of having to suffer as a consequence of that, etc. If it's after you're dead, there should be no problem. So please do so. It's a nice, very good idea. Make use of the body rather than just burn it up or whatever. Here. Dear Ajahn, in agriculture, farmers often have to use pesticides to destroy living beings to get bumper crops. So how is a vegetarian different from a non-vegetarian? Is a bug's life less worthy than an animal's life? Thank you very much. Yeah, that's a good question, right? It's an important question. The question is that there is always, when you are a human being, you're going to kill. You cannot avoid killing. Killing is part and parcel of being a human being. And just by walking back to your cootie tonight, you're going to step on some insects, right? Sometimes you step on those millipedes or whatever they're called by accident, and kind of they go crunch, and they're flat afterwards. And that's just the nature of being one of those beings. You are very vulnerable to all of these kind of things. Even if people don't want to kill you, they still kill you as a consequence. So yeah, that's a good point. So remember that what matters in life is your intention. And if you want to be a vegetarian and you come from a sense of compassion, you're still doing a good thing, right? Because you're acting from compassion. But it is a point that usually almost anything, any activity involves killing, even deliberate killing of living beings. So similar kind of problems can easily arise. You could perhaps argue that killing insects is perhaps a little bit less serious than killing lots of large animals, perhaps. But it is not, you know, the difference isn't perhaps that great. So thank you for that. Dear Ajahn Mamali, I feel sad that the trip is almost over. Oh, Dukkha. When and where is your next Siddha retreat? I'm actually leaving for Sri Lanka on Wednesday, and it's going to be next Siddha retreat starting in Sri Lanka on Thursday, so it's very, very soon, but not here, unfortunately. Can we access this information on the website? Usually you can, because usually these Siddha retreats, they happen here on an annual basis. That's what I'm doing so far, and there's a limit to how many retreats you can do because, life is, even as a monastic life, sometimes too full, too many things happening here. But there should be one next year as well, I think the dates are pretty much settled, so it will be the very first week of June, I think, next year, probably. Things are anicca as always, so always uncertain, but that's likely to happen. And that should then come up on the Jhana Grove website at some stage. So the Jhana Grove coordinator, Bird, is sitting at the back there. So you can ask Bird later on if he can tell you what's happening here. Bird, you want to raise your hand? Everybody can see who you are. Huh? Yeah, that's Bird over there. Yeah, she's the master, Jhana Grove, the master here. The final say, apart from Ajahn Brahma. Okay, so here we go. Next question. I heard you say about how Chitta the householder once taught the monks because he was more attained than they were. Is this the only circumstance a layperson would teach a monastic? I have heard people say that lay teachers teaching monks is a sign of the decline of Buddhism. Is this in the suttas anywhere or just an idea added later on? Probably by monks. I don't think the sutta says that Chitta the householder taught because he was more attained. I don't think that's actually what it says. That may have been the case, but it doesn't actually say that. I think it says that if the monks don't teach me, I will teach the monks. I think that's all it says there, really. So I guess he wanted to hear a Dhamma teaching, and if it didn't come from the monks, he would deliver it himself. And so, but it's quite a nice idea, isn't it, that whoever has the ability to teach, whoever does it, can teach. There's no reason why not. And I know that in places like Sri Lanka, it's quite common for, you know, sometimes monastics to go on retreats taught by lay people. These things happen. So there is no absolute hierarchy. The question is just where, who knows the Dhamma the most. And generally speaking, if you have a good monastic who is practicing well, then hopefully they will know a bit more because they're spending their whole life doing it, right? So hopefully that's the reason why monastics tend to kind of be the teachers. So that is really the only reason. But there's no absolute reason in this. And sometimes, you know, things can be the other way around. Is it a decline of the sign of decline of Buddhism? No, I don't think so at all. It's just common sense that you listen to those people who have a profound understanding of the teachings. So. Okay. Okay, maybe the theme for next year's retreat could be a few of my favorite things. And you could teach some of your most favorite suttas. I always teach my most favorite suttas. So you have to let me know which ones are yours. Okay. It is beautiful to see your enjoyment of the suttas. That, I think, is what makes it work so well. So the more you enjoy it, the better it will be for everyone. It's a good point. So I should choose only the nice ones. Only the ones I really like. Yes, that's good. And the other thing which I like to refer to practical suttas. I'm always a bit afraid of getting too sidetracked into theoretical issues. I think it's important that people get some things that they can actually use in the daily practice. It doesn't have to do with just about meditation practice, but just the general practice of Buddhism, I think, is important as well. That's kind of my idea anyway here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, could you please explain a little bit more about consciousness and subconsciousness? Consciousness. When I did a hypnosis session, I experienced those two as two different things. Okay. Well, these are really words that are used in kind of Western psychology, right? Western psychology has the idea of consciousness and subconsciousness. And maybe the closest in the suttas to subconsciousness is the idea of the underlying tendencies, right? This is probably one of the things come closest to that. The underlying tendencies are tendencies inside of you. If they haven't been completely eradicated, they're just waiting to come out at any time. That is perhaps something like subconscious. So, you know, if you haven't eradicated the underlying tendency to anger, if somebody comes and pokes you a little bit, you kind of erupt in anger because of that, right? Or if Mara comes and entices you, then you erupt in desire as a consequence. So these are like, in a sense, perhaps like subconscious ideas. But I'm no expert on this by any stretch of the imagination. I'm quite ignorant about modern psychology. So maybe what you can do is ask some of the... We have a few psychologists in the Buddhist society. Maybe you can ask them about such issues. They might be able to give a better answer than me. But I think that is as far as it goes. And apart from that, I think there isn't much subconsciousness really in Buddhism. Most of it is actually experienced reality. Most of it is about how we experience things. Now, some of the things we may experience in them very, very weakly, kind of on the side, but they are still part of our conscious experience, except for these underlying tendencies, the anusaya, they call them Pali. So when I did the hypnosis, I experienced two different things. Yes, okay. As I said, I don't really know enough about these things to be able to really differentiate that clearly, what they actually are. Okay, so there you are. That's unfortunately the best I can do. Dear Ajahn, do you think Ajahn Brahm would consider another 6-month retreat? Or has he finished his work? Would you consider doing one? How does one know when one is ready for such a retreat? What is the purpose of such a long retreat? Allowing stillness to build? Would Ajahn Brahm consider another one? I'm sure he would consider it, but he might decide not to do it anyway. I'm sure he probably considers it all the time. I'm sure he'd be very, very, very happy to do so. But I think it's difficult for him because he also feels that he has a lot of obligations and things. Or has he finished his work? Well, even if he had finished his work, he might still want to go on a six-month retreat, right? Even the Buddha went on retreat sometimes, so he might still do it, regardless of that. So I'm not going to answer that question. You can have to judge that for yourself. Would I consider doing one? Yes, perhaps at some stage I would. Not sure when, but possibly. How does one know when one is ready for such a retreat? Well, the answer to that is basically in the suttas. Everything, so many things are found in the suttas. And the answer is that once you have deep samadhi, once you have the jhanas, once you see the jhanas in you, that is when you are ready for these kind of retreats. In other words, staying by yourself. And the reason for that is because then you have the stability of mind, the ability to deal with all the circumstances. Otherwise, you probably won't. And it's very easy to go crazy, right? If you go on retreat and you come off this wild-eyed kind of madman afterwards, right, with hair everywhere and staring. And this happens, right? This actually happens. These things. People who are not ready, they think they're ready, and they actually end up going a bit crazy as a consequence. So these are actually important issues to take into account. But once the samadhi is there, particularly once you have the jhanas, that is really the time to do it. So what is the purpose of such a long retreat? The purpose is to allow the stillness to build. That's precisely it. You allow the stillness to build, and the more stillness you have, the more insight you can get on the road. That's part of the same thing. Yeah? So that's really it. Because too much distraction, and you will destroy the buildup of the stillness. You go through the jhanas deeper and deeper and deeper. Right? This is how you do that. And there are people in Sri Lanka today who live almost permanently on retreat. There is one very famous monk, who we actually have a picture of him on the wall at Bodhinyana Monastery, and he is pretty much permanently living in a jungle in Sri Lanka. And he kind of comes out once a year to have a chat about the Dhamma with some of the monks, and then he disappears back into the jungle again, and he stays there 51 weeks a year. Doesn't hardly talk to anyone, right? He might talk to the villager when he goes Pindabat and gets his food, and then he gives them a blessing perhaps and says a few words of encouragement, and then he plunges back into the forest, and that's where he stays. And it's quite inspiring, right? And this monk is also known to be quite an inspiring example. And it's astonishing how people can live like that. But he obviously, he loves that lifestyle. He's been living like that for 30 years or something. So, there you are. Okay, one more question now. Okay. Dear Ajahn, referring to the simile of the acrobats, does it go beyond minding the business of another to that of the world affairs? Minding the business of another to that of world affairs. In other words, it is not our business to take care of the world's problems. Our responsibility is just to take care of ourselves and get out of samsara. Please comment. Thank you. In a sense, that is true. And in a sense, our job is to kind of get out of samsara, get out of suffering. So that is certainly the case. But as you practice that path, as you do all the right things, often you have an impact on the world anyway, right? Or sometimes you just use whatever opportunity you have to do something positive for the world, to do something positive for other people, and in this way you actually do have an effect on the world. But you don't have too much attachment to the outcome. You don't look at whether you are really effective or not. If it doesn't work out, if it doesn't give you any, you don't get too many results of what you're doing, you can deal with that. You can actually work with that, and you're not so worried about that. So you do a little bit. You do some of your business, and then you kind of get out. And the main focus is always on the spiritual practice. That is the main thing. You don't start getting involved in worldly affairs to the point where it damages your own practice, it damages your own progress, because at that point it becomes counterproductive. So that is, I would say, how you kind of balance the worldly things with your spiritual things. But of course, one of the powerful things as well is that when you do practice the spiritual life, is that often you have all kind of unintended consequences. You do all the right things, and if you become an arahat, suddenly you become this beacon of light for the world. Everybody, people who see you get inspired. People who see you want to practice the path as well. And this is kind of one of those unintended consequences. You didn't do anything for the world, but somehow the world is still affected by what you're doing. So it's kind of strange. And remember also that it is true that we don't necessarily get too involved in worldly affairs. But at the same time, you have to have this open heart, the heart of generosity, the heart that is always willing to help other people, the heart of compassion and kindness. If you haven't got that heart of kindness and compassion and generosity, you won't be able to get into the samadhi states. You have to open you up in that way, and then you can really get things happening in your own practice. Okay, so that is the last question. So there's still a few hours left of the retreat, and I'll see you tomorrow morning. I think it's 8:15, so a little bit later than this morning and the rest of the retreat. And for the in the meantime, please enjoy your last night, and then we'll see you again tomorrow morning. Let's just finish off with the Arahang again.